You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today. We're here today with two people.
At the same time as me, so that comes to three people.
Hello.
And there's one of them right now. We're
Hello.
Here today with Sherry Antonetti, and we're also here today with my Wednesday co-host, Mr. Rod Bennett. Hey, Rod.
Hello, hello.
And so we're all here together, the three of us, talking to each other on the air.
All right. And we finally made it. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's
I
all right.
I don't know that we've ever been introduced, Sherry.
Oh, well, yes. Please meet Sherry Antonetti.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
You too.
I was looking at one of your talks online when he said you were coming on, and I was really enjoying the story of the field in the woods. That was very funny.
Yeah, that's sort of the jumping off point for the most recent book. So, yeah. Well, that's good. Well, you've had a look at me. I hope that doesn't put you off too bad.
No. I enjoyed it tremendously.
That's good. That's good. Well, you know, I enjoy just helping friends meet. That it's what I do.
Well, that's great.
Wherever you go, virtual and actual life.
I'm a midwife for friendships. That's
there you go.
It's why always think of me as their, you know, their kindly uncle.
How
are you feeling today, Mark?
I'm no longer at, I was operating at about 10% because you have to be, you know, at least have minimal autonomic functions and things like that. That was last week. I came out with the flu last week and it was just the worst. So I collapsed into bed Tuesday evening, having given my wife, mind you, a lovely red flower because it was Valentine's Day.
Very
and
nice.
I am a good husband and a romantic. I then collapsed into bed where I remained asleep until Friday morning.
Oh, wow.
When I got up, well, I did get up on Wednesday and Thursday long enough to send Jen Longworth at Breadbox Media a message saying, "Too sick, can't do show." And then went back to bed.
Oh.
And then I got up on Friday and thought, I'm still too sick. And so I didn't do the show on Friday either. So basically, I've done nothing since
you've
last
been on
Tuesday.
Tape all, you've been like Wolfman Jack. The man has been on tape all week.
Yeah.
Hey, there you go.
Pretty much it. So if you listen to the show last week, it was a show from a time period when I was still alive. And now I am back. I went to Mass yesterday, which turned out to be a major endurance test. I got about halfway through the Gloria and thought I was going to faint. And then just kind of held my ground and then sort of made it through Mass and came home and tipped over on the couch and slept all afternoon and then went to bed last night. And I took a couple of those, you know, coughing, sneezing, so you can rest thingies, the gel cap thingies.
Yes.
And I slept for another 8 hours. And today I'm still sick, but not as sick as I was. So I decided I would do the show today. So
here,
and there's
here in
nothing
East Tennessee,
more interesting.
We eliminate the middleman on that DayQuil and all of that stuff, you know. just, that stuff is alcoholic, yeah. You know, anyway. That's the main ingredient. So we use the family recipe up here, and it achieves the same effect. And,
Is that whiskey and honey or bourbon and honey? Which one?
Well, it's our whiskey that we make here in the hills. So
there you go.
Yeah, it's,
And you can strengthen that formula by just getting rid of the honey.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
True.
You don't really honey get any acts better. You just don't care anymore that you're sick.
Right. Yeah. Honey acts as an unwanted stimulant. You know, what you really want is to just go to sleep. And knowing as I do that listening to me talk about my health is compelling radio.
Yes.
Compelling people to switch the channel.
I thought maybe we would we'd change the subject a little bit and have a little conversation today. I get feedback
you,
from
Mark.
Readers, and I get no, it's not actually. Okay. We're going to make this about you guys today.
Oh boy!
Well. So, I get mail from people, not infrequently, who are interested in the writing life. They want to be writers.
Cool.
And which I think is good, since it's what I do. And by no coincidence whatsoever, it's also what you guys do.
It is.
And so I thought it would be interesting to have a show where we spend a little time just talking about the writing life, and especially sort of keeping in mind those people who are just starting out, who are interested in becoming writers, want to know about, you know, how do you do it, and et cetera, et cetera. What's, you know, are there magic formulae? I'm here to tell you there are not. What can you do? How do you do this thing called writing? How do you get started in it? Are there basic things that you need to know?
Grammar.
Grammar and spelling and, you know, all those, unless you're E.E. Cummings, you know, the word stuff, you know. I just thought to spend a little time talking about that. There's so many different kinds of writing.
It's true.
I write primarily, I've made my living writing non-Catholic, or non, well, some would say non-Catholic. Non-fiction, Catholic stuff about theology, which is like, talk about the least promising way to be able to make a living.
It's esoteric.
It's pretty esoteric. But as it's happened, God has sustained me over the last 20 years writing about that.
So it might be your vocation, you know?
I have doubted it, actually. I think that's part of it, you know. But I would be interested in hearing from you guys. First of all, just how did you wind up getting started writing? What were your motivations? And, you know, what was it like the first time you, it doesn't even necessarily have to be sold a story. The first time you publish a story, very often the first time you publish a story is not the first time you sell a story.
Yes.
A lot of times it takes you a while before you figure out that someone will actually pay you for things that you write. And it's like, what, they give you money for this? I just did it because it was fun.
I'm waiting for the J.K. Rowling type bucks to roll in. But, you know, so far that hasn't happened.
Just George Soros gravy train, you know.
There you go. Well. Who would you like to go first, since you're our guest today?
I was going to suggest you in the spirit of ladies first, although that might be out of date.
I'll take it.
There you go.
All right. Well, I started writing. It was very serendipitous. I got asked to give a speech at our parish. about why I sent my children to Catholic schools. So I wrote wrote my speech, and I gave it, and someone said afterwards, you should send that into the Catholic school Standard, which was the local Catholic paper, for Catholic Schools Week. So I did, and they sent me a check, and I was like, wow.
That's cool.
You know, that was exciting. So I immediately started pestering and making myself a nuisance with that particular editor, and I learned the first lesson, don't annoy the editor. But I got bit by the writing bug, and so I joined a writer's forum, and one of the things I was interested in was humor. So I wrote a humor piece, and I submitted it, and I was the dog that caught the car, because my second piece that I sold was to the Washington Post, which blew my brain.
Wow.
It takes a year for it to get published, but I was still excited. I got it in the Post. So at that point, I'm going to do this.
As a professional question, let me ask you, what does the Washington Post pay?
This was for the Style Source. If you want to look back and find, I was writing about losing my cell phone and the trials of going to the cell phone store to get a new one. Okay. But they paid $250 for that piece.
How many words?
It was about 800 to 1,000 words. I was pretty excited. I was a stay-at-home mom, and I had at the time, you know, seven kids, and I was kind of stunned that I could do that.
Well, that's pretty cool. Well, we're up against the break, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti and Rod Bennett talking about the writing life, and we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, recently risen from the dead.
There is life after death.
Ready to talk about, we're talking about the writing life today with Sherry Antonetti and Rod Bennett, both of whom are writers, as it happens. And thought we'd do this just for the benefit of people who are interested in becoming writers. If you're out there and you want to be a writer, this is your chance to talk to three writers about that whole thing. So by all means, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. Give us a call with any questions that you've got about the writing thing. By the way, I brashly asked in the last segment, because Sherry was talking about having sold, what was it, your second piece ever?
My second piece ever was to the Washington Post.
That's pretty good. And they actually paid you a tidy sum. $250 is not bad for a thousand words.
Yeah, for a total bum rookie who's like, what?
Yeah. You know? Good. So anyway, so during the course of the conversation, I said, how much do they pay? That's the sort of thing that people feel funny about asking. And that's the last thing that you should feel funny about asking if you're interested in being a writer.
Yes, that's the thing. You should get paid.
Right. Well, and it's kind of important to get paid, because it turns out that writers go on having metabolic functions. such as the
as long as at least some money comes in.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing that especially fledgling writers do, and there's no shame in doing at all, is having a real job first.
Yes.
Don't think of that real job as the ball and chain. Think of it as home base. the place where you have got a steady income coming in while you're pursuing what you want to do. When I wrote my first major book was a book called By What Authority. And I wrote that book using a brand new invention that we had at
typewriter.
It was chiseled.
He's not
on
quite
paper.
That old.
That's right.
It's quill.
Chiseled on cave walls with animals' bones. It was called a laptop.
Wow.
Amazing thing in the early to mid-90s. And I started working on the book. And until I could afford a computer, I eventually got my own highly advanced 486 computer. And got it installed, and then I was able to work. But you could borrow a laptop from the office and bring it home on the weekends, where
wow.
the place that I worked, they let you do that.
Nice.
And so I started working on By What Authority on this laptop, and the whole thing was done, written in the evenings and on the weekends. And a lot of writers work that way, and it's
That's what you do.
Yeah. And have no shame about asking for money and all those kinds of things. Rod, how did you get started?
Oh, goodness. First thing I ever had published was I was 14 or something. I wrote a Christmas story. They announced that there was a competition to, it wasn't, I don't know. They didn't give a prize or anything. They just said, send in your Christmas story. We want people to write a new Christmas story. So my favorite author in those days was Jules Verne. I wrote this basically Victorian sci-fi type thing along the Jules Verne lines where Victorian gentlemen in a balloon get blown off course to the North Pole and they find that Santa Claus is real, but it's all done with science. He's this Captain Nemo type recluse who lives at the North Pole, you know. So,
steampunk so Santa. I like it.
Well, I sent it into the paper. They liked it, and they printed it up. And, I mean, it was pretty long, actually. And they printed it, and it got a pretty good little response. So at 14 years old, I was off and running.
That's cool.
That's pretty cool.
I don't know that ever noticed it after that, so I don't know that this was the beginning of any kind of career. The first people that ever paid me for anything, I guess I've done a few little freelance things for Christian and Catholic, both before mm-hmm. and after my conversion publications, where I did little freelance pieces, but I never was very good at freelance. Writing is really difficult for me. It's not, some people just dash it off. I've got a friend who, he just likes the feel of a pen in his hand, so he just carries around yellow notebooks. And so he'd be writing whether anybody was publishing it or not, I'm not like that. Every word is like giving birth to me. So I'm slow and I agonize. So I don't feel like being slow and agonizing over this week's article for which you get $50. So
on the greatest expert on giving birth in this whole group, I'm going to say epidurals are great. So probably by that real cure that you talked about,
you're
for
the authority.
Cold,
you're
might
the
be
authority.
Work.
You
know,
but yes, so I write books. Books are the only thing that lives long enough and rewards me enough for the pain and suffering. So
okay.
I don't really do freelance.
Do you outline your books before you start, or do you have an idea and then work from that?
I've got an outline. It may not be very detailed, but I've got a trajectory. I know, where I've got to get to and, what the final goal is and where I should be by this point in the story. So
there are different, I've discovered through excruciating experience, that there are different kinds of muscles that you use depending on, I am speaking metaphorically here.
Yes.
There are different kinds of muscles that you use depending on the kind of writing you're doing. So I mentioned earlier, my work has been almost entirely Catholic nonfiction. I will periodically will write a lark, almost always a comic lark. In fact, always a comic lark. You know, so a satirical essay or, you know, some kind of. One time I wrote a source criticism analysis of The Lord of the Rings. The whole thing just suggested itself to me. Thank you. It just suggested itself to me one day, and I dashed the whole thing off in about a half an hour and giggled the whole time I wrote, and sent it off, and it got published by Crisis, I think, and then I stuck it up on my my personal website, and stuck a link up to it, yes. And I got a friend named Sandra Measel who was involved in. She's done a lot of Comic-Con things. I have. Just a Lulu of a picture of her from about, I don't know, 40 years ago, dressed as Jadis from the Chronicles.
Oh, my goodness. Oh,
from the Chronicles of Narnia.
I love her already. I love her for doing that.
She was formidable, I'll tell you. Anyway, she wrote me and she said, you should send a link to this thing to onering.net. Which is like the all Tolkien clearinghouse of the whole universe on the web.
It's somehow terrifying, but go ahead.
The movies were coming out. It had huge, huge numbers of clicks. So if I'm guessing it's about the same time.
It was about the same time. And so I did. I just, on a lark, I just you know, got the webmaster address and said, you might be interested in this. And the next thing I know... my website was just like buried in hits. There was just an immense readership for this article. This is probably the single most popular article I ever wrote in my entire career. And it was just because of onering.net noticing it. And I never made a nickel off of any of that. But what did happen was a woman out in the Midwest, in Kansas, I think, who's a member of the Mythopoeic Society, who is a part of the, you know, the fans of OneRing.net, read the article. And she was putting together a scholarly book of essays by critics talking about the films of The Lord of the Rings. And so she wrote me and said... we were kind of wondering if we could stick this essay in at the very end as like a sort of an after dinner mint.
Oh, that's great. I love it.
For
that.
All of these, you know, after all of this heavy film criticism, I said, knock yourself out. Can I have, you know, can I buy copies of the book at the author discount? Yeah, sure. And so for years and years and years, there was this book that came out called Tolkien on Film, and I would order like 10 copies of Tolkien on Film at the author discount, and then I just stick it on my book table. So I wound up making, you know, a little bit of money that way off of that essay. But, you know, these are the odd little bits of serendipity that happen in a writer's life. You just never know what's going to be enormously popular.
True.
Yeah. So
a lot of success in this area depends on serendipity.
It sure does.
It's a providential life, yes.
There you go.
We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti and Rod Bennett talking about the writing life. And we'll be right back after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
The Dots, and your host Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti and Rod Bennett. And we've been talking about the writing life, and I'd like to go back to you guys. And so you talked a little bit about, you know, you told your origin story.
Yes.
My radioactive spider, yes. Rod, yes. I think, drank
gamma rays.
And if memory serves, I think Rod said something about drinking from some kind of super radioactive moonshine or something.
That's what it was, yeah. Strange chemical.
And strange chemical.
Doesn't actually turn you into Captain America. It just makes you feel like you are.
There you go. I love it. I love it. That's good. That's good.
And so I'd like to ask you guys a little bit about, I'm a young writer. What would you tell me as far as jeepers, Ms. Antonetti and Mr. Bennett? I love your work. How do I find a subject to write about? What should I talk about? How do you guys decide what you want to talk about when you write?
Well, there's the cliche, write what you know, but I'd also say you write to discover what you know. And the surest way to become a writer is to sit down and to write. And that sounds pretty basic and forward, but it's like, how do you become a runner? Well, you get on your shoes and you go outside and you run. And as you run, you get more skilled. Well, the same thing is true for writing. It's a habit, and it's a willed habit. You can't just decide to hit if you write when the writing muse hits you, you are a hobbyist, or you might be, you know, someone who just has a journal or diary. But if you want to be a writer, you have to write when you're not inspired. You have to sit down every day and say, I'm going to do 500 words.
Yeah.
And that's therein lies the rub.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have to write when you're not inspired.
Yeah. Some people would say, from the evidence, I always write when I'm not inspired.
But you're going to fake it until you make it is the plan. And that's really what you do as a writer.
Although I got to say, Rod, it's, you know, you are a born storyteller, and
yes,
it shows every time you write. Your book, Four Witnesses, is just super fun to read. And it takes a subject that to the naked ear sounds extremely unpromising, yeah, in terms of, you know, crackling good storytelling, namely the sort of scholarship on the first four great fathers of the church, what are called the apostolic fathers, which is the kind of thing that a lot of people hear that and they just think, I won't even need a sleeping pill. but that book is just gobs of fun to read because
their
world come alive. Yeah. And so, for example, what prompted you to write a book about the apostolic fathers?
Well, it's really the story of my conversion, to tell you the truth, because the one single compelling thing that sealed the deal for me in becoming a Catholic Christian was this early testimony to what the early church was like. So it was a very, very compelling thing in my own life. And, you know, as I was reading the stuff, I was thinking, you know, this is like some kind of best kept secret. How come I never knew about this, you know? And, I thought there's gotta be a lot of people out there who would think this is as cool as I do. And, so it was excitement. It was the idea of, wow, more people should know about this. This is sort of a best-kept secret that hasn't been talked about much, so there's a good opportunity to write something here. But it was, you know, it's funny. I never set out to be a writer, but I did have a lot of ideas that I wanted to get across. So, you know, the writing was just something I had to do to get it out of my head and into other people's heads.
Yes. So,
there you go. That's, yes.
That's I've got a burning idea that I'm trying to put over.
I hear you exactly. Yeah, the reason I got used to work at the University of Washington in the health sciences division, and I came to the conclusion that I really wanted to be a teacher really bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I got into almost at the exact same time I did two things. I had begun writing on the suggestion of a friend of mine, Sherry Waddell, in fact. Began writing because there were things that I really wanted to say as a new convert. And I also went into teaching school and discovered as a teacher that I hated public school teaching because there I was with an audience full of people who were trapped prisoners who were there sullenly enduring whatever it was I had to say because they had to be. And I just thought, I don't like teaching people with a gun to their head. That, you know, just there because they have to be there. And they all hate it. And, you know, trying to drag interest
out of them. CCD is a lot worse.
Yeah. But what I did find was that when I wrote, I got to say all the things that were burning a hole in my heart. And then somebody published them. And I didn't have to hold a gun to anybody's head. You read it if you wanted to, and you didn't if you didn't.
Yep.
And when it was all done, people wrote me back, and they said things like, I never saw that before. That's really interesting. And it was like, this is why I write.
Yep.
And so, yeah, there are people who write in order to write. I write in order to teach. That's what I've always done. I want the lights to come on, and watching the lights come on is the great satisfaction of my life, and writing is the vehicle for that. And right. If I can find other ways to do it, I will do that too. So I will go and speak as well. And I love doing that because then I get to see the lights coming on.
That's cool.
So yeah, that was a great driver for me. Was that.
Yep. That's very much like my own feeling.
Yeah.
Frustrated teacher.
I'm a teaching assistant, so I'm not quite frustrated yet.
Okay.
Okay. Fair enough.
But that may be because I don't have to do the lesson plans. I just get to be enthusiastic and say, let's do this.
That's good. No. So so how about you, Sherry, when you're coming up with, you know,
satire.
What do you want to write about?
Well, I mean, I do a lot of, you know, originally started out doing mostly just humor. I really a lot of it was humor because my favorite author growing up was Irma Bombeck. I read her books. And I mean, I was a kid and I was thinking it was hilarious and just could not get enough of it. I read them over and over and over again. So humor originally was a way of trying to sift through the insanity of trying to raise 7, then 8, then 9, then 10 children. And actually, the genesis of that humor writing was me sobbing on the phone to my father about the trials I faced trying to get my children potty trained. And I was so irritated because when I was a special educator, before I was a mom, I actually taught kids with special needs to be potty trained so they could go to job sites. I was theoretically good at it, but I was incompetent when it came to my own children. And so I'm so irritated and I'm complaining. And my father said, well, why don't you write about it? And so I wrote this humorous piece called The Potty Wars, which details my failures with all 10 of my children. It started out as with all 5 and then went, you know, added on as we went. And that's how I started writing humor.
There must have been at least one for whom it came easily.
Well, there was the one that came the fastest, and that was 3 days before my son, and I won't name which one it was about to turn 4. His cousin, who was born 3 days before him, was turning 4, and she had potty trained, of course, at 2.5. And so I had explained to this son that it was illegal in the state of Maryland to turn 4 unless you were potty trained. This is the mark of a desperate woman.
That's like when potty trained mom took him to the police station when he was little.
And he potty trained that day. Which tells you that it was simply an act of the will. It was
you
not
just needed to be properly motivated.
That's right. So that was one of my not so bright motherhood moments, but I'm still not sorry because it worked.
Well, you might grow up like Hitchcock to be a great filmmaker.
There you go. Well, he since has embraced that story, and he's used it with some of his younger siblings to explain to them the same consequence, although nobody's snapped to as fast as he did as a result. So a lot of it was out of frustration, and you know, these days it's with adolescence and applying to colleges and dealing with paperwork and you know, the trials of homework, which I've discovered I despise. You know, it's that. And my natural dysfunctional organizational skills. And how, you know, so that's what most of my humor is about now. Except when, I'll stop.
Oh, that's fine. Okay, well, you're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Sherry Antonetti and Rod Bennett talking about the writing life. And we'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett and Sherry Antonetti, and we're talking about the writing life. I thought we might spend a little bit of the last segment just kind of talking about things like, you know, what do you do when you're starting out in terms of, you know, Rod, you've mentioned that you don't you're not a freelancer, so you're not cranking out articles for print media, for like periodicals and magazines and so forth.
Yeah,
and
now, I tried that for a while, and it didn't work. I just would slave over something, and you know, I'd get $150 back, which worked out to about 30 cents an hour, and I thought, well, I might as well get a job.
Yeah, I hear you. but in terms of you know, when I'm writing for, excuse me, when I first started writing, Sherry, your mic is too close to your mouth or something.
Sorry.
That's okay. When I first started out, one of the things that I had to learn was just how to write a query letter. A lot of people aren't familiar with query letters. A query letter is sort of it's your audition, really, for an editor that you don't know. So there's no big editorial conspiracy to keep you from being a successful writer. That's one of the first things that's important to understand. If you're a new writer and you're worried about it, a periodical is a gigantic Hoover vacuum cleaner that is in desperate need of copy every, well, depending, you know, if you're the Washington Post, it's every day you need copy. If you're a weekly, every week you have to fill all those pages. And if you are a monthly, every month you have to have copy for those pages. So editors are always on the lookout for new writers. Because they desperately need copy.
Yes.
And so you've got that in your pocket. And so what you do when you write a query letter is you go out and you figure out the magazine that is a good fit for the thing that you wanted to write about. Or if you're an adaptable person, You go find out what kind of thing that magazine wants, and then you try to give it to them if you think you can do that.
Yeah, and you look up submission guidelines, and that helps a lot.
Right. Find out the submission guidelines, figure out things like word count, don't go over it.
Yes.
And then you write them a query letter, and very often the query letter will be the opening of your article.
Yep.
Because what the editor is looking for is a snappy, interesting, engaging letter that will begin with, you know, there I was suspended 1,000 feet in the air above, you know, Yosemite or whatever. And you know, you're extremely interesting opening paragraph that is the thing that reaches out and grabs the reader and makes the reader say, I wonder what the next paragraph says. And then eventually you can kind of segue from that into, hi, I'm Mark Shea, and here are three extremely interesting and compelling reasons why you need me and me alone to write about this thing that you desperately need to hear about. And then you polish that off, and then you send it back. Back in the day, you do all this on paper and you would send a self-addressed stamped envelope, but that's back in the Pleistocene. Now you just email and you say, if you're interested in this, just let me know and I can deliver you an article of X number of words by X date. And then you send that off to the editor, and depending on how busy the editor is, you'll hear back from them. And the odds are pretty good that what you'll hear back is, yeah, okay. You know, send it along, let us have a look. And then you send them the article. And, you know, make sure the article is...
good grammar.
Good grammar, yeah. I mean, spell things right. Make sure your publication is... Your punctuation is right, and so on and so forth. And you can just... you know, attach that to your next email, and then you send it off and you wait for them. If you get a rejection, welcome to the writing life.
Yes, you are now a writer because you, yeah. You know, I mean, if you read like Stephen King's On Writing, he kept the rejection slips and he taped them on the wall.
Right. That is not the verdict of the universe on your value as a human being.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Except it is. Yes, that's correct.
That's how it feels anyway.
It can feel that way, but it's really, really not.
Have a chocolate bar and write again. You know?
There is no such... there literally is no such thing as a writer who has not received a rejection letter. It happens. You know, and don't worry about it. 9 times out of 10, the reason you got the rejection letter is because it just wasn't a fit for that magazine. They're just not looking for that thing.
And if you quit after the first time you get rejected, you won't become a writer because you can't, you know, it's like having to win first prize every single time. You won't work.
Right. So you plug away, you go back. One very valuable tool to go out there and get as soon as you can is something called a Writer's Digest. Or I'm sorry, a writer's market. You get a writer's market, and it's this big fat book that will cost you a pretty penny, but it will talk about all the different kinds of markets out there, all the different kinds of periodicals, and give you details on, you know, what it is they publish and who their editorial staff is and what they want and what the word count is.
But an easy way to find all that would be also to look at what you like reading now, because that's probably what you like writing. And so if you look at what you're reading, look for what you read is what you want to probably be writing. Look in their submission guidelines and you can get a good sense.
My favorite publisher for years before I was Catholic even was Ignatius Press. And so when I wrote a Catholic book, I said, I'm going to send it to Ignatius Press. So I didn't have to really go through all of that stuff. I just lucked out. I sent it to the publisher I wanted to publish it, and they liked it. So
yeah, they liked
That's
it.
That's great. Hey,
it was all the races after that. So Now, I wrote a novel that I couldn't persuade anybody to buy, so now that I do have a lot of experience with writer's guides and query letters and all of that. An agent that didn't work out, kept it for a year and couldn't sell it. And then when he finally quit, I got to see his material that he'd been using to try to sell the book, and it was totally wrong. It was almost like he didn't like the book and was trying to explain it away. So he was saying,
really?
Okay,
well,
this
bad.
Book is really weird, so I'm going to make it less weird by explaining to you why it's okay. So I'm going to have to try that one again someday. But
that's a shame. Maybe just go get a different agent.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I'll do, yeah. But I'm in the middle of a different book right now, but when I finish this one, I'm kind of got a revision of that novel about halfway finished, and so I'm going to make it a lot better and then take another crack at it. So.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of rewriting my first book and then also working on a second one that's sort of a sequel to it, and I understand it's messy going back in because you have lots of stuff that you've fallen in love with and you discover, oh, no, that's bad. Pull that out right now. You know?
Right.
So it's like trying to reweave a carpet that's already woven and you have to go fix a thread in the middle. It's really a mess.
It's just like that. You know, it's funny. You guys talked about getting the grammar and spelling and all of that right. I think it may be different for books, but if somebody asked me about book publishing, I'd say don't obsess over the grammar and the spelling and stuff. They've got people that do that. You know, they've got hard you try. Well, with Four Witnesses, for example, I slaved over it. I thought that if they discovered a grammatical mistake or a spelling error, they would realize that I'm a fraud, that I'm not really a writer.
Yeah.
And that I'm trying to put something over on them. So I slaved over it. It took much longer to get that book ready because I used every known spell checker, every known grammar checker. I had three or four people read it over and stuff. And I was encouraged when they first looked at it. They said, oh, it seems like a pretty clean manuscript. It shouldn't be that difficult to get it ready for publication. And then when they sent proofs back for me to look at, every page had five or six red marks on it. Things to go back and fix.
Yep.
And it's just, you wouldn't have believed it, but it was true. And I realized they've got lots of people that can do that. What they don't have is lots of people that have compelling ideas. So I'm told that C.S. Lewis was the worst speller ever.
That's reassuring.
So what I would say from my experience is that if your idea is good and if what you're saying and if you can write, because there's not really much connection between being able to write and being able to spell, believe it or not. And so if I had one tip to offer to the aspiring book writer, I'd say don't kill yourself over
all right.
spelling.
Just write.
All right. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both, Sherry Antonetti and Rod Bennett, for being on the show today. This is lots of fun. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer today was Danny Head. And I will be back, I trust, aliver.
I hope so.
Perhaps. Who knows? Tomorrow. And we will talk to you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So long, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.